Florida activists say justice for George Floyd is a victory in a long-running fight. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we welcome the CEO of the local advocacy group, 90 Forward, to discuss the Chauvin verdict and take your calls. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, some good news for your Wednesday. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The coronavirus case count rose again in the state by 5,645 to a total active case count since the pandemic began of 2.18 million. Deaths rose by 62 overnight. The death toll now in the state is 34,532. So please keep masking up and get those vaccines. Well, reaction continues this morning around the country and the world after police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all counts in Minneapolis Tuesday in the death of George Floyd. The trial had been one of the most closely watched cases in recent memory, setting off a national reckoning on police violence and systemic racism. The local advocacy group 90 Forward works on these issues here in Jacksonville. So right now we're pleased to welcome CEO Dr. Kimberly Allen to the show with her thoughts. Dr. Allen, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And let us know your thoughts on the verdict in the trial of police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, Dr. Allen, I think the whole country was holding its breath yesterday waiting for that jury to come in with the verdict. What were your initial thoughts?
I was also holding my breath, Melissa. Quite frankly, it's troubling to me that we even were holding our breath in the first place, but we were. And the relief that I think swept through the nation was just one to be felt for sure. And you know, I'm grateful that we, you know, the verdict was guilty on all three counts. But it still, you know, begs the question of how have we gotten here? What is the system that has led to people having to hold their breath for something that seems so obvious?
Mm-hmm. Right. And certainly there was a fair amount of cynicism about whether the jury would convict Chauvin. Juries typically have very rarely convicted police officers in these kinds of cases. It was the video, the 9 minutes of video, right, shot by a 17-year-old girl named Darnella Frazier that made this case such a flashpoint because we could watch with our own eyes what was happening.
Absolutely. And, you know, quite frankly, these things have been going on long before we had phones to video record them. I think the shock, though, of some people, I mean, some people need to see. Seeing is believing, in, unfortunately, in a lot of cases. But I hope that, you know, from this moment on that we can start to take a closer look, even when the cameras aren't rolling in incidences, to make sure that that Black people and other people of color are receiving fair treatment by our law enforcement.
Let me ask you about that, because you work on these issues in Florida. There is a piece of legislation that passed the U.S. House of Representatives last month, but it faces an uncertain future in the Senate. It's called the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. It would set up a national registry of police misconduct to stop officers from evading consequences for their actions by moving to other jurisdictions. It would ban racial and religious profiling by law enforcement at all levels, and it would overhaul qualified immunity. That's the legal doctrine that critics say shields law enforcement from accountability. What are your thoughts about this legislation?
I think it's definitely a first step of many steps. I think, you know, there's the sweeping legislation, right, that comes on the federal level, but we have to even get down to the state and the local level to make sure that it's implemented and make sure that it's followed and make sure that there's accountability locally, and do things like ban certain types of chokeholds and different methods and, you know, train differently and really uncover implicit biases that all of us face, but particularly in our law enforcement as well. So I think that is certainly one way to start to navigate the injustices, but there are certainly a lot more steps to take.
Right. I mean, there are 18,000 police agencies in America, of which JSO is one. How do you interact with JSO when you talk about these issues?
So we just recently had a soil collection ceremony for a young man, Willie Washington, who was murdered back in 1924, I believe, 23 or 24. And he was murdered at the hands of police. And we had actual police officers who came to the ceremony to pay their respects and to speak out and say that this was not something that, you know, that they wanted to perpetuate. So we always want to applaud the officers and the law enforcement officials who are willing to step in and do the right thing when it happens, and hopefully even when the cameras are not rolling. But we were grateful to have them present with us.
We're speaking with Dr. Kimberly Allen, CEO at 90 Forward. You published an open letter on your social media feed yesterday, an open letter to the community, where you say that over the last year, we've all deeply felt the impact of the numerous traumatic, tumultuous events fueled by racism and inequitable race relations. You remain vigilant in fostering productive conversations around race in an effort to address all areas of our city's history and move Jacksonville to a future where racism no longer exists. That's the goal of 90 Forward. Is that a realistic goal? Can we ever get to that future?
So that's actually a topic that we wrestled with internally when we were identifying that as our vision. And what we arrived at and what I wholeheartedly feel is, whether or not it's attainable, should we not strive for it? We should still aim for that to be the end. And it may not be in my lifetime. It may not be in my children's lifetime. Or it may not ever come where we're in a, you know, quote-unquote post-racial society. But that does not mean that the fight to get there stops. We have to persevere until race is no longer a deciding factor in who gets equitable treatment or fair or healthy or a positive outcome.
We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Here's an email from Jay. He says, all that can be said following the Chauvin conviction is justice for Micaiah Bryant. No sooner than an instance of injustice is addressed, another one replaces it. This is why people are calling for police to be defunded, disarmed, and significantly reformed. We cannot solve this problem one conviction or one police force at a time. I believe he's referring to a 15-year-old girl in Columbus, Ohio, was shot and killed by police yesterday when they responded to an altercation of some kind there. And so Dr. Allen, calls to defund the police. There's been quite a bit of discussion about that. And that whole slogan is seen by some as simply making it harder for Democrats to win elections, frankly. I want to ask you your thoughts about calls to defund the police. Where does 90 Forward stand?
So in terms of, you know, I think it's lost, sadly, the intent behind the slogan defund the police. What is really underneath that is, how can we take funding and put it more into the social services that help to prevent even one needing to have to interact with the police force? The police respond to quite a number of things, and I attend the Safer Together meetings that are run by Council Member Boylan and Council Member Joyce Morgan as well, and we are listening to the police tell us about all of the, you know, the mental health calls that they receive, or the things that really could be handled by professionals who are in that arena if we were willing to put funding in that space. And so I think it's being heard as defund the police, and it's been tagged that. But really, it's how can we increase funding to the social services necessary to help people get the help that they need before having to interact or interface with law enforcement.
Right. And, you know, with 18,000 different police departments in this country, they tend to have different procedures, different policies. Does there need to be uniform policies on how to use force? Is that a realistic thing to expect?
Honestly, I don't know that it's realistic, but I do think at a start, having some legislation at the federal level start to get at what could be considered uniform. And then the states and the local entities in those, you know, 18,000 plus police units or law enforcement units will need to take their actions to determine how to best implement those things. But I think it really involves a critical look at all of the policies with a fine-tooth comb with community members who are being policed and over-policed in some cases to say that this is, you know, these things that we think or these antiquated rules that were once here no longer apply or they shouldn't be here. Or here's another way to deal with that. But I think that that's a process that has to happen with community and not, you know, for community or to community, because the community is being impacted. And we always want to create spaces where community has a say in what's taking place and what's happening to them.
You have an event coming up at 90 Forward, too, where you'll be fostering this kind of discussion, right?
Absolutely. On May the 11th, which is a Tuesday at 6 o'clock p.m., we will be hosting a When Is It Safe to Be conversation. And it's honestly, it's almost a year to the date where we hosted one last year around When Is It Safe to Be Black. And we were talking about Ahmaud Arbery, but I want to say maybe a couple of days prior to us having that event is when George Floyd was murdered. And so, you know, we had to incorporate that and incorporate the findings around Breonna Taylor. And so here we are again, nearly a year later, having this conversation again. And we want to provide the community a safe space. That's our, you know, that's our calling card. How can we create safe and brave spaces for community to coexist with each other and share their feelings about all of these things that are happening? And then we work together to create healing solutions and how we can take action together.
All right. It's 549-2937. Richard is on the north side. Hi, Richard.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Allen, I have had the opportunity, as you know, to teach your children, if you recognize the voice, and want to say thank you for the great work that you are doing. I want to emphasize the fact that the 15-year-old that was killed, ironically, on the exact same day of the George Floyd verdict, was actually 3 years old when President Obama was elected. And I have been screaming this at the top of my lungs since I've been here in Jacksonville, that I can tell you where the next 16-year-old that's going to get in that kind of trouble is. They are 4 years old right now in preschool. And if we don't focus on that area, we're going to continue to miss the mark, because 12 years from now, we'll be talking about the next 15-year-old and the next 15-year-old. I believe that, you know, when is it, the next question should be, when is it safe to be a child? And it has not been safe to be a child in this country since we got on this path of divisive elections and adults fighting. And our children are literally sitting in the room of our society watching these adults go at it. So I'm not surprised that our children are behaving like the adults have taught them to behave over the past two decades. So I'm hoping that we can begin to change that and recognize, if we can just say, hey, 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 there are children in the room, what are we doing? It'll change the conversation. At the very least, it'll make us not ignore them and recognize that they need to be shaped to be great citizens in our community. I'm hoping to work with all these organizations like 90 Forward and the other ones that are coming out there, because it's going to take all hands on deck.
Yeah. Richard, thank you. And thanks for working with kids in that way. Dr. Allen.
Yes. Hi, Mr. Richard. It's good to hear your voice. But, you know, I will say that is one of the things that keeps me up at night, Melissa. I have three small children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've said this, folks who have heard me talk publicly have heard me say this, you know, right now, people say your children are so cute and they're so smart and they're brilliant and they're all of these things. And, you know, they're all of these things that only a mother could love, certainly. Mm. But I fear for them, right, as they get older. My son is tall, right? We come from a family of tall people. I worry that people will you know, mistake his age or mistake his intent. And something like, you know, what we see happen to this young woman could happen to my children. And so that's one of the reasons I fight every day in this work, because I don't want another child, another mother, another father, to lose someone that's important to them. And, and additionally, you know, that's part of the reason, too, that we're starting to work with young people. How do we take the energy and the feelings that they have and turn them into advocates, and so that they learn their rights, that they learn how to stand up for themselves and advocate and stand up for others? And they're doing it. Young people are doing it. If, you know, I'm thinking about the school name change situation mm-hmm. that's here in Jacksonville. I think about the youth that are moving for gun reform after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas incident. And so the young people are moving. The adults absolutely have to join arms with them and support them and help them to build their muscles as they grow to become advocates.
549-2937, Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. First, I want to say I'm satisfied with the verdict in the Chauvin trial. I think that was a horrible example of unnecessary use of force against an individual. But I kind of wonder, yes, there are some bad policemen out there, but I'm a firm believer the vast, vast majority of policemen are called to serve, and they serve in an admirable way. But yet, many times they are put in a predicament or a situation where they don't know what's going to happen. As recently as about a week, maybe 2 weeks ago, a police officer was shot on a routine traffic stop. And he didn't know what he was getting into when he walked up to the car. So my point is, I think many times we could alleviate a lot of these issues if individuals would simply do the things that the police ask for them to do. Now, yes, there are examples of bad cops who overreact or use their badge inappropriately. I get that. I'm all for rooting those people out. But I'm also a believer if I got pulled over right now, I'm going to do the exact same things that the policeman asked me to do. And I wish that there was that kind of, for lack of a better word at this moment, respect for that authority among everybody out there whenever they come into contact with the police for whatever reason.
Well, I understand that, Mark. But that said, should someone who resists arrest be dead? Should they be killed for resisting arrest or not complying in the right way? I mean, I think that's really more the issue.
No, you're absolutely right. I don't condone that in any shape, manner, or form. But I think that, and that's what I say, there are instances where people are abused, but I think that's fortunately, a smaller percentage of instances, but they do get banned and made more popular by news coverage and that kind of thing, and discussions even like this. But I'm not minimizing those mm-hmm. issues, at least I'm not trying to.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just saying that many times we hear the news stories where if someone would have just followed the instructions of the police and not begun a risk of resisting arrest, and I'm thinking like the gentleman up there in Atlanta that fell asleep on the drive-thru line at Wendy's. Everything was fine until he decided to start wrestling with the cops and go up with their gun. You know, I hate to see those instances, but, you know, that could have been avoided.
Mark, thank you. All right, Dr. Allen, you know, part of the reason I think that we have a problem in this country is that this is a country awash in guns. Police officers understandably are afraid when they go into certain situations. Now, that said, I think I tried to make the point with Mark that just because someone resists arrest or doesn't comply with police orders doesn't mean that they should lose their life. So these are complex issues, and I wonder what you're thinking as you heard him call.
Yeah, so I think about, you know, Philando Castile, who followed officers' commands and was still shot and killed. I think about Mike Brown, who had his hands up and was still shot and killed. I think about, you know, folks who have run away, folks, all of the people who have complied with officers' demands and were still had their lives taken from them. And so at what point is it no longer about just complying than it is about, you know, the responsibility being on law enforcement, the people who have the training to be in these situations, the people who have, you know, they are armed, they have weapons, they have things, they have different tools that at their disposal to be able to defuse situations. At what point is it no longer just comply and you'll get out of it? Because I'm literally thinking about a situation just a couple of days ago with my brother. My brother is a very tall, 6'6" guy, hefty guy, very strong build. And he was followed by police for going to a store. He did nothing wrong, but he was followed because someone said, oh, he looked suspicious. So at what point is his liberty, his right to be a human and walk around and shop in a store with his wife, at what point does that become suspicious and warrant them being followed by the police? The situation could have escalated very quickly because of, you know, his size and his stature. There is, I think that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I think we also have to think about the trauma that America, all of America, all of Black America is experiencing every single time we hear about one of these incidences where folks are being pulled over for routine traffic violations or what have you. There is already a heightened sense of, you know, oh my gosh, I'm being pulled over by the police. Let me call someone. Let me put my hands up. I don't know what to do.
I know how nerve-wracking that can be. For people of color. And let's have the deeper conversation, if we could quickly, that reformers are asking, why do police have to be in the business of pulling someone over for an expired tag or an air freshener dangling from their mirror? You know, in many communities around the country, these traffic stops are intended just to generate revenue. You know, and they're not necessarily improving public safety.
Right. Someone sent me an article the other day, and I forget where it was in, probably the north, you know, northern east coast. And there was some idea to stop the sort of routine, quote unquote, traffic violation. So let's stop pulling people over for expired tags. Let's stop pulling people over for an outed tail light, because those things have, you know, that's how it starts, right? It starts with a routine XYZ, and it escalates because people are already hypervigilant on both sides, the person who's being pulled over, the police officer. And so is it possible that we've create some reform around not having those things be reasons that people get pulled over, or a way to handle those things.
And let me just get a few more colors on, if I could. Amira, yeah, on the west side. Amira, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I just wanted to say I disagree with Mark, and I wanted to give an example. About a couple months ago, we're in the lower part of Florida, Ocala, and my white friend was driving. And I don't know if she was speeding or whatever. I was kind of sleepy. A police officer pulled us over, and the first thing he asked me for, not her, is her driver's license. When I asked him what he needed my driver's license for, I was immediately, you know, kind of... And in the end, it could have escalated, but I gave him the license, but I felt incredibly uncomfortable with it, because why do you need to know who I am as a passenger? Mm-hmm. And according to Mark, I should have just complied. So I couldn't disagree with him more, because we're treated different as soon as a police officer sees us, sometimes, and unfortunately more often than white people. And that's the only thing I had to say.
Amira, thank you for that. Thanks for sharing your story. Okay, Bonnie at the beaches. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, my call is in response to Mark. And first of all, I want to say thank you, Dr. Allen, for the work you're doing. We actually met at the last soil collection ceremony, and I appreciate 904 so much. I think that Mark's response epitomizes white privilege. It shows a lack of awareness of what black and brown people face when they're addressed by the police. And I think the police officers have the responsibility to de-escalate and control and treat with respect. And I think about the young boy in Jacksonville who was acting out, had a gun in the car, and the police response was to shoot 33 bullets into the car. That was not an intent to subdue or de-escalate. That was an attempt to kill that young boy, that young 18-year-old boy. So I think this should be looked at as a learning opportunity, but that clearly demonstrates a lack of understanding of what black and brown people face when they're stopped by the police and surrounded by three or four police cars as opposed to a white person. And that's all I have. I'll take a response off the air.
Thanks. Okay. And thanks to everyone who shared their thoughts. One more from our Facebook page. Tom writes, I was holding my breath for that verdict too. The near simultaneous arrival of the Chauvin verdict and HB 1 taking effect in Florida was alarming. That's the new anti-rioting law in Florida, Dr. Allen. Mm-hmm. And you did put out a statement yesterday calling for peaceful demonstrations in the wake of the verdict. So can you share one more time with our listeners the upcoming event so that people can take part in the 904-word discussion?
Absolutely. It is a When Is It Safe to Be community forum that will be taking place on Tuesday, May 11th at 6 p.m. We will be announcing panelists at a later date, but we wanted to go ahead and get that out to the community so that we could come together and talk about these things that are plaguing us.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
I appreciate your time, Melissa, as always.
She's Dr. Kimberly Allen, CEO at 904-word. And much more still ahead this morning later. Some good news for your midweek. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. But up next.
So as a market executive, I have the privilege of leading the Merrill Lynch offices across North Florida.
One local leader on growing more female senior leadership in the financial services business, a growing sector here in our area. We'll be right back. Welcome back. She is an executive focused on recruiting more women into leadership roles in the financial services industry here on the First Coast. I spoke recently with Sabine Villani. She is the director and Merrill Lynch Wealth Management Market Executive for North Florida. Hi, Sabine. Good to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Melissa. It's nice to talk with you.
So tell us about your role at Merrill Lynch. You are overseeing the North Florida market, hundreds of employees, about 20% women, and you're trying to recruit and promote more women and getting them into your line of work, wealth management. It tends to be a male-dominated field, so tell us about this.
That's right. So as a market executive, I have the privilege of leading the Merrill Lynch offices across North Florida. And that includes helping our financial advisors and their teams serve clients as efficiently and comprehensively as possible by really connecting into the full breadth of solutions and resources that we offer. And as part of that, I also focus on hiring and developing talent in our market, including the next generation of our advisors. So one of the core areas around that is really focusing on looking for strong, diverse, talented individuals, advisors who can really benefit from what we offer and thrive at Merrill. And that's both new advisors who come in through our training program, as well as experienced advisors who want to come in and further develop their practice at Merrill Lynch as well.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the barriers that you see in this field that are holding women back? And how are you as a senior female executive now trying to help them get over those hurdles?
I think for individuals who are pursuing this as a newer career, I think you mentioned it. It's historically been male-dominated, so I think coming in, breaking some of those barriers, and learning the business, it's important. And to facilitate that, we have a very strong training program. It's got a national structure around it, paired with what we do locally in our offices to help support and coach our new advisors to get up and running and to set them up for long-term success.
Mm-hmm. Coaching is key. And what's it like for you now? You're serving as a role model for younger women. You're creating a female pipeline, a female network. Tell us what that's been like for you and what that means for this region of Florida, by the way, too, where we now have at the Jacksonville Chamber a vice president of Elevate Women. Angela Timberlake is her name, and she is trying to grow the C-suite in Jacksonville and corporate boards with more women at these senior positions.
That's right. So, a bit of background. I've been with Merrill Lynch almost 16 years, where I've been fortunate to have taken on some different opportunities and roles with great mentors along the way. And that's what I want to do in the role that I'm in now, as far as helping elevate, as many people as I can. And I think the women, element of that is certainly important and strong. So, we do a few different things in our market all around development and support. So it comes in many forms. One of the ways that we do this is through a peer-to-peer forum or advisor-to-advisor coaching that we facilitate, which is extremely powerful. And candidly, every time I've asked an advisor to spend some time sharing their best practices with other advisors, the answer I've always gotten is a resounding yes. And that's truly part of, the fabric of our culture of helping each other.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we're also launching is matching women advisors in small groups to connect with each other throughout the year. So a little bit of a different twist on a traditional mentoring program, which we've also done. And that's something I'm excited about as well.
Very nice. You also counsel women on how to get on a more equal financial footing in the workplace, whatever field they're in too, right?
That's right. I mean, just to take a step back, our commitment to diversity and inclusion really starts at the top, at the leadership levels of Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. And as I mentioned, it's core to our culture. One of the things I'm proud to share is that Merrill Lynch was actually a leader amongst financial firms in sharing our diversity data publicly as it relates to our financial advisors for greater transparency across the industry, which also showcases that we're holding ourselves accountable to continuing to make progress here.
So what advice do you have for other firms that are, after really, let's be honest, it's been a long time coming for corporate America to really get on board with these ideas. What advice do you have for other leaders out there in our community who really are taking a hard look at these problems and trying to build a more inclusive workplace?
Sure. So it's a moral imperative as well as a business imperative. And our research team recently published a piece on diversity and inclusion. And some of the things that jumped out at me, I'll read you a couple stats. Women's wealth is growing at 1.5 times the pace of men's. Women's wealth increased from $34 trillion to $72 trillion in just 10 years. So we can think about that trajectory. And research suggests that, companies with higher diversity have higher earnings potential. So there's a correlation there. And research also tells us that more emerging talent wants to work with companies that value diversity. So I think the imperative is very clear.
Right. Well, I want to thank you for sharing your insights with us. It's good to have you on. She's Sabine Villani, Director and Market Executive at Merrill Lynch Wealth Management here in North Florida. Thanks, Sabine.
Thanks, Melissa.
Well, it's Wednesday, and it's the time on the show when we take a pause and note some positive news and notes that have caught our eye this week, our What's Good Wednesdays. And this week, it's a special Earth Day edition. Tomorrow is Earth Day, and so we want to make sure you know about a cool opportunity to celebrate our Mother Earth tomorrow night with a drive-in movie event in Neptune Beach. It's a screening of the groundbreaking documentary, The True Cost. This film is about the clothes we wear, the people who make them, and the impact the textile industry is having on our world. So check it out. Get out of the house, stay socially distanced, and learn some important information. This screening is sponsored by local activist brand Enact. They focus on connecting with other change makers on social and environmental issues under the 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals. Now, here's some inside info. We've got a code for you. If you want to go see The True Cost tonight in Neptune Beach, this is a drive-in movie screening, just search the link on Eventbrite, type in the code EARTHDAY, and get a free ticket. I'll say that again. It's the insider code to go see the Enact screening tonight of the documentary The True Cost. Search it on Eventbrite, type in the code EARTHDAY, and get your free ticket. Have fun. Well, congrats to local author, foodie, and man about town, Jeffrey Speer. The judges for the 2020 Florida Book Awards have recognized Speer's book, My Life in Gluttony, A Culinary Adventure, and they've bestowed a gold award in the cookbook category for excellence. This is a fun read, and it follows Speer all around the world as he explores exotic foods and then comes back home to the First Coast. Get your copy and support a local business at the same time. You can get them at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach. Well, speaking of food, we want to give a shout out to the fabulous and locally owned restaurant, The House of Leaf and Bean, and chef and owner Wen Ratey. Now, here's what they're doing. They're hosting their first annual Kids Cooking Healthy Contest for kids 7 to 12 years of age. So here's what you need to have your child do. Email their recipe and contact information and a story about why your child likes to cook for the family. Send it to Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance by July 22nd. And your child's recipe should fall into one of the following categories: vegan cookies, sliders, or flatbreads. We are going to have all this information in our newsletter, by the way, too, if you're missing some of this as I'm saying it. Okay, let's give a shout out to Trevor Lawrence, the number one draft pick and soon to be Jaguar, fingers crossed. Thanked fans on Twitter this week for all of the wedding gifts that have been sent to him and his fiancée, Marissa. And Lawrence says to show his gratitude, he's going to donate $20,000 to local charities. That is a fabulous way to start a career in Jacksonville with the Jaguars, don't you think? Okay, and then finally, don't miss Friday's show. We're going to speak with my old acquaintance, the great Mort Krim. Now, you might not have known about this retired award-winning broadcast journalist, but it turns out that Mort, in a very roundabout way, inspired the hilarious Will Ferrell comedy Anchorman. It's a really funny story, actually. Krim has lived here in our area for many years, and he shares his stories of the TV news business in a compelling new memoir, Anchored. We'll hear more from Mort on Friday. And if you've got some good news to share, email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And sign up for our newsletter, by the way. We send it out every week, highlighting positive things in this time of pandemic, which will hopefully be over soon. Find our newsletter sign up at wjct.org and also check out all of our digital news there. Okay, I want to get off the good news for a minute and talk about something else important because we have a little extra time. It's a nasty part of spring in Florida, termite swarms. They are scourging the city right now. Have you seen, maybe driven by someone's house and seen that brightly colored tarp over the whole house? That's how you know they're being treated for termites. Well, for many parts of the country, the spring season marks the beginning of warmer weather, blooming flowers, and yes, termites. Here in Florida, where we have warmer temperatures year-round, the nasty bugs can breed and infest homes even earlier in the season. The warm and humid climate associated with our area just makes it the perfect home for many different species of termites. Here's the key. You need to understand what species you're at risk for and the signs of termite damage. That is how you can protect your biggest investment, your home. Aaron Borgman is a service manager at Terminix in Jacksonville.
You know, we have multiple species here in Florida. Different ones swarm at different times of the year. This is kind of the prime time for swarm season. The weather's changing. It's getting a little warmer out. The rain seems to be picking up. That's perfect, optimal conditions for termites. Seeing swarm activity all over the city.
And Borgman says, here are the signs you need to look out for. Mud tubes, they're used by termites to reach a food source on the exterior of the home. Soft wood in the home that sounds hollow when you tap it. Darkening or blistering of wood structures. Discarded wings near doors or on windowsills. That could be indicating a termite swarm too. And they can be mistaken for flying ants. So if you're confused, you're not sure what you have, if you think you might have a termite problem, you know what to do. Contact a pest professional. We're going to take a quick break. And in a moment, I'll look ahead to this Sunday's Oscars. In this pandemic year, it's a very different awards season for Hollywood. Our occasional commentator, Mike Favo, has connections to one of the Best Picture nominees, Nomadland. We'll hear his story next. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Therapy apps are filling both the desire to connect digitally and our ongoing need for social distance. New York Magazine features writer Molly Fisher joins us to talk about her first-person experience trying these apps, which don't always deliver on their promises. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Tanya Mosley. As the vaccine effort in the U.S. expands to include all adults over 16, our neighbors to the north are still limiting vaccines to people mostly over 55. Why is Canada so far behind in the pace for vaccinations? Also, will it be possible to reach herd immunity not only in the U.S., but the world? That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Courtney B. Vance. He plays Aretha Franklin's father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, in the National Geographic drama series about Aretha's life. Vance was in the recent HBO series Lovecraft Country. He won an Emmy for his portrayal of Johnny Cochran, O.J. Simpson's lead attorney, in the series The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Our relationship to the environment is tied to where we live and the connection we have to that place. That's driven many to fight for clean beaches and plastic-free oceans. But others, including many people of color, feel excluded by the mainstream environmental movement. So who's pushing the movement to focus on environmental justice? We'll find out next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the 93rd Annual Academy Awards are this Sunday. It's a ceremony forging ahead, even in the midst of a pandemic. And it will be a very different kind of Oscars this year, given that almost all of the films up for major awards were streamed on platforms like Netflix. We watched most of these movies sitting at home rather than going out to see them in the movie theaters. Now, the film Nomadland is heavily favored to win. It's a roundly acclaimed movie from an exciting director. It's already ruled at the Golden Globes, the BAFTAs, the Producers and Directors Guild Awards, stars Frances McDormand. We will watch to see if it takes top honors Sunday. At the same time, this Best Picture nominee, Nomadland, struck a chord with our occasional contributor, Mike Favo. He has a personal connection to that part of the country where the story is set. Let's listen.
Of the 8 Best Picture nominees for this year's Oscar, Nomadland is the only one I have seen. I assume the other 7 movies are excellent, but none of them open and close in Empire, Nevada. A small desert town I had the pleasure of visiting 7 or 8 times as an employee of the United States Gypsum Company. Nomadland's story centers on Fern, an Empire resident set adrift when the factory and quarry closed due to the Great Recession. This closure left employees without their jobs, along with inexpensive rental homes in the company town. Throughout the movie, beautiful and impressive American landscapes are showcased in contrast to Fern's ruddy cheeks, scarred van, and bare-bones necessities as she completes an 18-month-long odyssey of separation from Empire. Media attention has been focused on the social issues her journey implies. Retirees left without homes. Amazon and other industries' use of migrant laborers. And the pervasive issue of elder care. While individual responses have been similar to my wife's comment of, "Wow, I don't know how anybody could live like that," or the text a friend sent as credits rolled, "Very depressing movie," with depressing in all caps. After I watched it, all I could think about was how much I liked visiting Empire and how glad I am that it has new owners and employees again. Empire, Nevada hides at the end of a winding, high desert 2-lane highway nearly 2 hours north-northeast of Reno. It was an oasis of gypsum and family life where employees and their families worked hard and played hard. My job took me there many times when the plant and town were managed by Ken Sam, a wonderful leader that treated every employee and visitor like family. This treatment was not limited to him. Everyone in the community was welcoming, impressive, and genuine. In conversations throughout the movie, viewers learned that Bo, Fern's deceased husband, loved his job at Empire, and the people there loved him. Her descriptions show her Empire life was more than marriage to Bo. She was part of a community and a tribe of connected people. The scene where she quizzes her one-time student of past lessons reflects her Empire life of mutual benefit and pride in shared accomplishments as a tutor. Later on in the film, another character asks Fern about Empire. She reflects fondly on many aspects of the company town, initially describing her house as not special, then changing her answer to describe its view of desert and mountain lovingly. The folks that lived and worked there never let anything get in their way, especially the perceptions of others not fortunate enough to live amongst them. The film ends with Fern taking one last walk through a plant and town that were overgrown, but still very recognizable to me. She cries, she caresses old touchstones, and she takes one last gaze at the vast desert and mountain view that I, too, think is simultaneously desolate and still beautiful before she hops in her beloved Vanguard. We viewers are left wondering for her destination. Nomad hideaways, gig work, or perhaps back to the coast and her friend Dave. Regardless of destination, I know that she too leaves Empire energized with nothing in the way.
Thanks for that, Mike. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Keep that feedback coming to us. We appreciate it. Send the emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can catch our podcast up later today on all platforms. You can also listen through the WJCT app to this show and all of our content here at WJCT 89.9. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.